have a informational session again today, and one of our top folks in the department is going to lead us through some of these different areas. So Colby Sullivan is going to shed his intelligence on us. And Colby, you want to sit here? Do you want to go up to the table? Okay. So we will start and turn the meeting over to Colby, and then when we have a quorum, we'll stop and pass these minutes. So, Colby, good morning, and take over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, I'm Colby Sullivan from the House Research Department. In your packets today, you have a copy of the slides that I'll be presenting from, and a few publications or fact sheets that I've developed over the years on some of the topics that I'll be talking about today. You also have a fact sheet from the Pollution Control Agency about livestock and the feedlot program administered by that agency. So I was asked to talk about some issues that recur or come before this policy committee frequently. So I thought a bit about the bills that tend to be referred to this committee and the topics that the committee tends to address, the hearings that we have. So just want to note that although I am familiar with all these issues and I do track them, I'm not an expert on any of the issues individually, so please ask me any questions you have, but if you have more detailed questions, those might best be addressed by someone from the agency who administers the program. So the first slide after the introduction is an outline of the topics that I'm going to discuss today. I'm going to talk about biofuels, food safety, Farmer Lender Mediation Act, animal feedlots or livestock farms, pets and veterinary medicine, industrial hemp, and the corporate farm law. So the first topic is biofuels, and the Speaker's office tends to refer bills that deal with biofuels to the Agriculture Committee. Sometimes they end up in energy committees, or the committee that has jurisdiction over energy topics, but often they come to the Agriculture Committee. And there are a couple of different laws that in particular that the committee sees bills on. First, there are currently laws that mandate the use of ethanol and biodiesel in the state. And the laws are structured a little differently. And I'm going to talk in this presentation here about recent changes, so members are aware of actions that the committee and the legislature has taken recently. So in 2013, the legislature changed what's commonly referred to as the ethanol mandate. So the ethanol mandate requires transportation fuel blenders and sellers to provide, in general, a mix of ethanol and gasoline. And that level is set at the highest blend authorized by the United States Environmental Protection Agency for use in all vehicles, and that's 10% ethanol right now. Or, as of 2013, blenders have an option of mixing in 10% of another advanced biofuel. So the advanced biofuels that we're talking about here could be ethanol produced from other feedstocks, such as prairie perennials, switchgrass, corn stover, things like that, or some emerging biofuels that are substitutes for gasoline, like drawing a blank on the fuel right now. Biobutanol, Mr. Chair. And so that was the change that happened in 2013. I think it was sort of a forward-looking change. I'm not sure how much of the advanced biofuel is actually blended into the transportation fuel and gasoline in the state right now, but that change was made, again, in 2013. In 2014, just last session, the legislature changed the mandate law for biodiesel. And the biodiesel law is set to increase the amount of biodiesel in each gallon of diesel fuel incrementally over a number of years. The legislature changed that law last year to state that when the state moved from B5 or 5% biodiesel to 10%, that mandate requirement would be in effect only April through September every year. Previously, it would also have been in effect in October. So with that change, now in the winter months where we are in January, the mandate reverts back to B5. So the change last year just dropped the month of October from the list of months when B-10 would have been required. And the legislature also delayed the implementation of the B-20 or 20% biodiesel mandate until May of 2018.
Mr. Sullivan, just a second, if we could pause for a second. We do have a quorum here yet, and we have three sets of minutes to approve. The January 21st, January 20th, and January 22nd. I'd entertain a motion to approve all three sets of those minutes in one motion. Motion by Representative Anderson. Thank you. All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And opposed, same side. Motion is passed. Thank you. Mr. Sullivan, if I heard you correctly, you mentioned a 2013 ethanol mandate to E10. Don't we allow E15 now?
Mr. Chair and members, E15 is allowed, however, it's not mandated. And the law states that in order for the mandate to increase above E10, the EPA would have to approve the use of that fuel in all vehicles, irrespective of model year. So the EPA waiver for E15, I believe, applies to 2001 newer vehicles. So those motorists have the option of purchasing E15, and stations have the option of selling it, but it's not mandated. So the next item under biofuels, members are probably familiar with ethanol producer payment program. Or
just a second again, we had a question. I didn't see it in time. Chair Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Sullivan, when we're talking about the biodiesel piece, there are some exemptions. Could you just refresh us what those exemptions are? And does that mandate also, is it mandated at, say, ports for international waters?
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton, I don't believe so. The exemptions are numerous, and they're on my biofuel use mandate publication. On the back, I have a table with the exemptions under both laws, both the ethanol mandate and the diesel mandate. And the exemptions in law for the biodiesel requirement includes nuclear plants, trains, off-road mining and logging equipment, generator manufacturers, and then the piece that I think ties in maybe with your question are Coast Guard boats and certain boats subject to Coast Guard inspection. And that change, I believe, is fairly recent and deals with some of the shipping boats, I believe, coming in and out of Duluth in Lake Superior. And then last year, it's also important to note that there was an exemption for number one diesel fuel from the biodiesel mandate, and the legislature extended that year-round and until 2020. So that's another exemption from the mandate for biodiesel.
Representative Hamilton. Okay. Go on, Mr. Sullivan.
So then the next item is the producer payments, or what was commonly referred to as the ethanol subsidies, and that began in the mid to late 1980s. That was a production incentive, essentially. It was set at 20 cents per gallon produced by qualifying plants, up to a maximum of $3 million per plant per year. And that changed some over the years. The payments were reduced at one point, and then with an agreement to make up the payments at a later date. So the final payments were made in fiscal years 12 and 13. And so in 2011, when the legislature made the final payments, the legislature also repealed that statute. So I still get questions about the producer payments and the subsidies, but that program has expired.
So it's safe to say that there are no more, at least on the state level, subsidies for ethanol, correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There are no direct subsidies. The state does still provide money for renewable energy research and development grants through the Next Gen Energy Board. So there may be indirect subsidies in the research area, but not the direct payments that we had before. And the next item is related to the ethanol producer payments in that when the payments were winding down, the Pawlenty administration proposed and the legislature adopted a program that would continue to make investments in agriculture, renewable energy, and rural Minnesota. And the chair of the House Ag Committee at that time essentially created a naming contest to decide what the name of that program would be. And to my knowledge, the only person who entered that contest was the CEA for the Senate Agriculture Committee. So he's the one who's responsible for AGRI, or Agricultural Growth Research and Investment Program. So that program has a pretty broad latitude, I guess, that it's administered by the Department of Agriculture. And it essentially retains a portion of the money that used to go for the ethanol producer payments. That money is still within the ag budget and appropriated to the Department of Agriculture for these grants. But it's important to note that the legislature set the AGRI program, the statute that authorizes that program to expire, and it will expire on June 30th of this year unless the legislature takes action.
Representative Hamilton.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I digress here a little bit, but I was pushing for the Al Junkie fund back then, and so we had a little fun with that.
Continue on, Mr. Sullivan.
Thinking if I should address that, but I think I better not.
So I just had one question. So that's the money pretty much is handled by the Department of Ag, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The statute gives the department direction on a sort of broad direction on how that money can be spent, but the law states that the department will determine how to allocate the money among eligible uses in consultation with the agriculture committee leaders in the House and Senate. So the way the statute has been interpreted is that it's ultimately up to the department to make that determination.
Okay.
And the final item is also related to biofuels. It's the Next Gen Energy Board. I think around the same time that the AGRI program was started, maybe a little bit before, members of the legislature were looking forward to the expiration of the ethanol subsidies and the development of maybe new ethanol production techniques and alternatives to ethanol, other biofuels, and renewable energy. So the legislature established a NextGen Energy Board. And the role of that board is to recommend projects to be funded through the Department of Agriculture and funding via the legislature that will advance these renewable energy technologies. So that board, similar to the AGRI program, the statute that authorizes that board is set to expire on June 30th as well. So that may be a topic that the legislature will address this session. That's all I have for biofuels, unless there are more questions.
Any questions from members? If not, to continue on again.
Mr. Chair, I'll move on to the next slide then about food safety. And members of the Agriculture Finance Committee yesterday heard a presentation on this from the Department of Agriculture. But I've, in this slide, tried to summarize really briefly how the duties are split between MDA, which is Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and MDH, the Minnesota Department of Health. I think of the health entity sort of as the hospitality industry, the restaurants, bars and lounges, beds and breakfasts, hotels, motels, resorts, etc., whereas the Department of Agriculture has jurisdiction over grocery stores, bakeries, convenience stores, meat and poultry processors, egg handlers, dairy, food manufacturers, and the list is actually more extensive. And in my publication I wrote with a colleague in my office, Food Safety System and Overview, I have a more extensive list on the table that shows the responsibilities for the two different agencies, health and agriculture, and the entities that they regulate. And as we heard yesterday, too, from members of the Finance Committee, the departments, both health and agriculture, have authority under state law to delegate inspection duties to local units of government, and then, of course, to withdraw that delegation authority if the departments feel that the local units of government aren't doing a satisfactory job. So in your districts, you may have local units of government providing these services, but that would most likely be under a delegation agreement with a state agency. The changes that happened recently in food safety are the final point on this slide. In 2012, the Department of Agriculture requested civil penalty authority for their food safety regulatory work, and that was granted by the legislature, so now the department could issue civil penalties for violations of food safety law. And last year, there was a change to address food safety requirements for farmers markets and chili or soup cook-off fundraisers. In the case of farmers markets, now the law was clarified, I think is an accurate way to describe the situation, clarified that food sampling and product demonstrations are allowed at farmers markets without a food handling license from the Department of Agriculture or a delegated local unit of government. But certain food safety requirements and practices still must be provided and maintained on site to protect public health. And for the chili or soup cook-off fundraisers, there's an exemption now from the Department of Health and their licensing requirements for qualifying events, and they have to be conducted by a community-based nonprofit. and again, certain conditions, food safety and public notification conditions have to be met.
Mr. Sullivan, mentioning or talking about the delegated authority to a local government in food inspection, for example, when the department does that, do they also help fund that job, or is that a cost that has to be taken up by the local county or city?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a good question. My assumption is that the department would provide funding, but that may best be addressed by someone from the department for a definitive answer on that.
And we have that definitive answer coming down to the table. And thank you for helping us out with that question. And good morning, and please identify yourself.
Santa Cruz, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Chair and members, we do not fund the delegated authority for local units of government. These would be only cities of the first class. Originally, there were 13 delegation cities that said we would like to run our own food program. They charge their own licenses. They pay for their own programs. The initial sales pitch of having this from the cities of the first class was that they would be able to do it cheaper and have a better relationship with their local businesses. I think it was originally six or seven said, we no longer think we can do this. They gave it back to us. We have taken one adversarially back for mismanagement, but they do pay for their own programs. They do charge their own fees, and we do have oversight authority over their procedures. But in most cases, their licenses are more expensive than ours.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cruz. Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, that's all I have for food safety.
Oh, had a question from Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not necessarily a question on the delegated authority inspectors. Just a little bit in contrary to what was just stated, our county is able to do that job and in general charge slightly less than what the state does for the same service. The one issue that we have, without any outside funding, obviously we've put it into a fee-driven program at the local level, but one of the problems that we do face is we get a good young aggressive person in there. They get 3-4 years of experience, and guess where they go to work? Mr. Chair, they go to work for the state of Minnesota, so we're glad to help by providing the training for those folks. But there are programs out there that do work at the local level and are been found to be as efficient and more efficient as far as cost basis than the statewide program. So just wanted to make that comment, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thanks, Representative. Colby, continue on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next slide is about the Farmer Lender Mediation Act. Similar to other laws I've discussed before, this one has what's called a sunset date or an expiration date, so it tends to come back before the committee every few years. The Farmer Lender Mediation Act, in essence, requires a creditor to offer mediation to a farmer before enforcing a debt of more than $5,000 that is secured by ag property or against a judgment against agricultural property. So I listed the actions that the law states this specifically applies to. So a foreclosure against a farm, repossession of farm equipment, cancellation of a contract for deed, or a contract for deed to purchase farmland, most likely, or a court order executed or a judgment that would be levied against the farmer's property. The University of Minnesota Extension Service is actually in charge of the mediation and working with the farmer and the creditor or lender to try to resolve the dispute. In 2013, the legislature extended the sunset date for the law by another 3 years, so it will expire next year, June 30th, 2016, without action by the legislature to extend it further.
And if there are questions on any of these topics, we do have some folks in the audience who may be able to add more light to the subject, so to speak. So, again, if you have questions, we have folks in the audience that could help with that. Mr. Sullivan, I've been around the track here a couple of times, and it seems like whenever this farmer lender mediation thing comes up, the discussion centers on that floor of $5,000 to initiate the process. Talk about that and the history of that number and with the inflation, for example, Would it be wise to look at increasing that number?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the $5,000 threshold for triggering the mandatory mediation, I would need to go back and look to the 1980s when the law was originally enacted to see if that was the level that was in place originally.
I think it was.
And you're certainly correct that that's a topic of debate when this law comes back before the committee. Each time it comes before the committee is if that's an appropriate level or not. In 2010, maybe, that not the last extension in 2013, but the extension before that, the legislature amended the law so that the amount of the debt that was available for mediation would be listed on the notice, the mandatory notice that's sent from the creditor to the farmer, because the extension service gets a copy of that notice, and the idea was that folks weren't sure exactly what the numbers were at that time, but if that amount were to be printed on the notice, and then the extension service could collect that data and know more about the size of the debts that we're talking about. So that was the legislature trying to get more information, really, to inform that decision about whether $5,000 is appropriate or not.
And were they ever able to track those numbers? Were those numbers, in fact, being put on the paper, the application?
Mr. Chair, I believe so. The statute for the Farmer Lender Mediation Act is a bit unique. Maybe it's pretty common in commerce law, but the law states exactly what the language that must appear on the notice, the offer of mediation. So I believe so. I believe it sort of has fill in the blanks for the name of the farmer, the description of the debt, and the amount of the debt. So I believe so. I mean, it might be best to hear from someone from the university on how successful they've been in tabulating that data, but I believe the way the law is set up, that information should be available.
Okay, thank you. We should look into that to see if the university does have some numbers on what those amounts have been when folks go into this process. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Sullivan, in the event this is not extended, what would take place? Would the farmers still have the opportunity for mediation? I mean, what would take place in the event there was a dispute?
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton, I don't know. I assume there would potentially be an option for mediation. It would just no longer be required. So I believe in the absence of this law, the creditor could just proceed with the foreclosure or executing a court judgment, and it would be, I suspect, up to the creditor to decide whether they wanted to give the farmer a chance to mediate the dispute with a third party or not.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a little bit of familiarity with this because we just did the extension in the last couple of years here. And, you know, the discussion about what the threshold is, I think that's important to note that keeping it low allows for mediation to happen, even though it may not seem like it's a huge issue, but especially for immigrant farmers and new beginning farmers, it's best to try to mediate early and get them acclimated to the process and be able to advocate for their position and have the bankers working with them. So it really, I wouldn't advocate personally to increase the amount because I think it was, we really talked about how we have a wide variety of farms and farmers engaged in that process, and mediation can be done at all levels, and even at a lower threshold, it's purposeful.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions or comments on that topic? And we'll be taking that up further, especially before the end of next year when this would expire if we don't take any action. So we'll hear more about this program. Colby?
Mr. Chair and members, then I'll move on to the next slide about feedlots or livestock farms. And I should note right away that the feedlot regulatory program is carried out in the state not by the Department of Agriculture, but by the Pollution Control Agency. So while I think livestock farming is certainly under the jurisdiction of this committee, the agriculture committees. Sometimes the bills go directly to the Environment and Natural Resources committees because the issue is treated, I guess, under law more as a pollution control situation than an agriculture situation, and that's why the bills end up in a different committee sometimes. But when Mr. Nisley and I talked about the presentation, we thought it was worth noting the recent changes to the feedlot permitting law. And in 2011, the legislature modified the law that triggers when permits are required for livestock operations, and then the Pollution Control Agency underwent the public rulemaking process to change its rules accordingly. And those rules took effect on May 27th of last year. And as a result of the statutory change and the change to the rules, National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES, Federal Clean Water Act permit, is only required in Minnesota now if it's also required under federal law, because previously state law required those permits for additional operations that were not required strictly under federal law to have a permit. So as a result, now in Minnesota, an NPDES permit is required for livestock operations that satisfy the federal definition under federal regulations of a large concentrated animal feeding operation, or CAFO, as it's more commonly called by that abbreviation. And that depends on the number of animals collectively on the farm. It varies depending on the species that we're talking about. And then the second piece that triggers the permit requirement is if the feedlot actually discharges to waters of the United States. And that's a result of a federal court ruling that required the EPA to update its rules. And that change then trickled down into our law and rules as well. But under the rules published by the MPCA, an SDS permit, a state disposal system permit, so the state equivalent pollution control permit, is still required for essentially the operations that previously needed an NPDES or NPDES / SDS permit. So those are livestock farms with 1,000 animal units or more. And for people that aren't familiar with the term animal units, that's the PCA within its rules, its attempt to quantify manure production by different animals. So again, there's sort of a formula, the number of animals times the amount of manure estimated to be produced per animal. If that meets or exceeds 1,000 animal units, then the SDS permit is required. And the legislature in 2012, it should be noted, changed the length of the SDS permit from, I believe it's 5 years, and now it's definitely 10 years. So the permit is in effect longer and needs to be renewed less frequently.
Mr. Sullivan, I had a question. The EPA is currently working on changing the term navigable waters to just waters of the U.S. And I see in your definition here, it just says waters of the U.S. So if they tighten the limits, and I think they mainly are talking about drainage, that type of thing, would that change in EPA rulings on navigable waters to waters affect the feedlot permits we have here in the state?
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question. I believe so. I believe that if the definition of waters of the United States of EPA were to change that definition, that would potentially impact the feedlot permitting requirements as well, not just drainage and other runoff from farms. So that is my understanding, but I'm definitely not an expert in the feedlot law. I'd have to research that some more.
Any questions? Mr. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sullivan, are there still cost share dollars available to help bring the small farms up into compliance? I know that we've had a pot of money to do that because I know that most small farms are exempt. And like it says here, they don't require a permit. But I know the legislature passed a while back to help offset some of that cost to bring people into compliance. Is that still available?
Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton, I believe so. I believe that money comes through the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And the law, I'm going to paraphrase here, I haven't looked at it recently, but I think it says that these operations, these open lot, smaller operations, are exempt from the feedlot requirements and rules and standards until there's sufficient cost share made available for them, the smaller farms, to make necessary upgrades to comply with the law. So I believe that then I mean, I guess I would assume that through the budget for the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, there is still money available for that purpose.
Carry on.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'll move on then to a slide about pets and veterinary medicine and talk a bit about kind of how animal-related bills seem to be referred to different committees. The Agriculture Policy Committee tends to be re-referred from the Speaker's Office bills that deal with both livestock and also pets, so companion animals, dogs, cats, birds. Those bills, I was going to say for lack of a better home, but this is probably the place that to hear those bills, but the committee doesn't hear that many bills. So, for instance, I don't have a lot of experience or expertise in those areas because we tend to receive and hear relatively few of those bills. But the committee also has been asked to hear and weigh in on bills about the practice of veterinary medicine. It was several years ago that the topic of horse teeth floating came before the legislature and whether someone had to be a licensed doctor of veterinary medicine to perform teeth floating or not. And that issue was resolved, and I think animal chiropractic care similarly, so that sometimes the committee wades into those issues as well. And the most recent law, and the most high profile, I would say, was last year the legislature enacted the Commercial Dog and Cat Breeder Licensing and Inspection Program through the Board of Animal Health. And I think we had a joint meeting when the Board of Animal Health appeared before the committee to talk about how that program is being rolled out and the status on that. But the committee certainly for many years before last session heard bills on that topic.
Vice Chair Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Mr. Sullivan would enlighten us with exactly the definition of the teeth issue with the horses.
Mr. Sullivan.
Teeth floating.
Mr. Chair and Representative Franzen, I'd ask anyone to jump in if they correct this, but I...
Any experts in the audience?
Well, I believe it had to do with filing down a horse's teeth because they grow continuously and need filed down periodically, and so that there were individuals who were performing that without being veterinarians, and then the question became, should that be a service that can only be provided by a licensed veterinarian?
We have a phone a friend, Representative Rarick.
Yeah, floating a horse's teeth is keeping them level so that they can chew their food properly and digest it.
And how is that done?
With a file.
Okay. And Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I remember that debate, and there was actually, it was interesting because the people that were saying it should only be veterinarians showed a video, and then the individual that was saying, look, I'm an expert, I can do this as well, that wasn't a veterinarian. And it was interesting because the people that were advocating to only have veterinarians do that, they showed a video, and the horse was constrained and was, you know, pulling back and everything else. And the guy then came up and said, look, we don't do that. And it was referred to as a horse whisperer back then as well, where this guy just came up and showed how gentle that he does it and how the horses respond accordingly. So it was pretty compelling that here you have an individual that was not a veterinarian that, in my opinion, did a better job, at least on the video, than the so-called experts.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a kind of a general question. Do we have a system in place from the House Ag Policy Committee that sort of keeps track of what the folks over in the DNR area are doing relative to wildlife management? Because we've got some very clear nexus with certain species relative to animal diseases, and so always concerned that we know, or at least have a look at things that would deal with rabies, for example, which are a huge issue, can be within livestock, and also tuberculosis, deer. There's a whole number of things that the disease doesn't care. It'll jump from animal to animal. So,
Mr. Sullivan, can you tackle that one?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lewick, I think there's sort of an informal system for tracking those bills, and I believe the chair can always request to hear a bill that has some overlap that maybe was referred from the speaker's by the speaker's office to a different committee, and to ask to hear that and to examine the agricultural implications of that. But I think that's it's just sort of an informal method when those bills come to the chair's attention.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Particularly in some of those diseases, and we've had an experience with tuberculosis up in the Northwest, and although that's probably a misnomer, it affected everybody that had livestock in the state of Minnesota. And we did have a real issue, obviously, within the cattle and the deer, so we really, I would stress that we really watch that particular area, because it took us over 5 years to get back to TB-free status and millions of dollars. We were pleased to also see our friends in the DNR were able to, for the first time in U.S. history, eradicate tuberculosis within a wild deer population, which is we've not been successful in other states. So it's a huge deal, and we do not want to go down that road again. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Thanks, Representative Lloyd. Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, the bovine tuberculosis bills were definitely heard in the Agriculture Policy and or Finance Committees when that was a big issue. Yeah. We may have heard from the DNR on the implications for the wild deer herd and the spread of the disease through that vector, too, but that was definitely an issue that the committees took up. And I'll move on from pets and animals on to industrial hemp. And just as I thought about bills that the committee has taken up frequently over the years since I've been here, the industrial hemp bill is certainly in that category. And like marijuana, I understand that industrial hemp, because it includes some smaller level of THC, is a Schedule I controlled substance under the Federal Controlled Substances Act. So that's a bit of the backdrop for the issue. The committee has heard bills that would explicitly authorize and then regulate the growth, production of industrial hemp in the state. I'm trying to think of the last time the committee heard that bill, but it's certainly come up over the years. The 2014 Farm Bill shifted the landscape a bit and said, notwithstanding the Federal Controlled Substances Act, institutes of higher education or state departments of agriculture can grow or cultivate industrial hemp for research purposes. If two conditions are met, it's grown or cultivated for research conducted under a pilot program or other agricultural or academic research, and both conditions have to be satisfied, and the growing or cultivating of industrial hemp is allowed under the laws of the state. So currently in Minnesota, that growing or cultivating industrial hemp is not explicitly authorized, but last year in the Supplemental Budget Act passed by the legislature, there was a requirement for the Department of Agriculture to examine how other states are implementing this new authority under the Federal Farm Bill and to gauge the interest of colleges and universities in Minnesota about whether they would like to participate in this directed limited research of industrial hemp. And as we heard recently, the department has produced that report, and I just kind of skimmed the executive summary because I think we might have a presentation from the department at a later date. But a couple of the main points that I took away are that 19 states have laws now regarding industrial hemp, and 3 have recently passed research laws that appear to be similar to or derived from the new authorization in the Farm Bill. And the survey sent out by the Department of Agriculture reveals that there indeed is interest among Minnesota colleges and universities to participate in this research.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great job there, Mr. Sullivan. Industrial hemp, oddly enough, is scheduled, or is a Schedule I, but gets classified under the same drugs as LSD and ecstasy. So go figure that, heroin. We can legally consume hemp. We can distribute it, and we can possess it. We just here in the States cannot grow it. And when I say we can consume it, what are we consuming it for? Well, hemp seeds are extremely high in omega-3s, I believe, omega-6s. You can drink it as milk, hemp milk, lotion, soap, concrete. This is an extremely renewable source of material as well, whether it be some now are starting to build some homes out of hemp with the concrete, clothing, biomass fuel. So this is a crop that the farmers obviously are not getting their fair share of the market because they can't grow it themselves. And instead, we are importing hemp into the United States, giving other countries our hard-earned dollars while we are, selling the items on our market. So Kentucky right now has harvested their first crop, and I look forward to having this discussion in this committee, Mr. Chair.
I can't wait either. And any other questions, questions or comments? Thanks for that little info there.
Yeah. You betcha. I'm just one walking infomercial.
Moving along to corporate farm law, Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's the final topic is the corporate farm law. It's certainly an agriculture policy issue that comes before the committee from time to time. And in essence, the corporate farm law, its stated purpose within law is to encourage and protect the family farm and to ensure it is the most socially desirable form of agricultural production. So the law then, as an extension of that, prohibits owning or operating of farmland by corporations, limited liability companies, pension or investment funds, trusts, and limited partnerships. However, the law does provide several exemptions from this for various different authorized family versions of the family farm corporations, for example, family farm limited liability companies, the entity makeup is specified in law. So if an organization or a farm wanted to qualify for one of the exemptions, that the composition of that organization is specified in law in order to qualify for the exemption. And that if an operation cannot satisfy one of the exemptions in law, then there's an opportunity to appeal to the Department of Agriculture for an exemption from the law if the proposed farming operation would not violate sort of the intent behind the corporate farming law. And in 2010, the legislature, that's a recent change, modified the corporate farm law to sort of expand the exemption for nonprofit corporations, so nonprofits who own and operate farmland. And that was a response to a specific situation that came to the legislature's attention that year. And I do have, if I didn't say it already, a publication, also a two-pager, on the corporate farm law. Talks a bit more about the history, some more about the exemptions, and the status of laws in other states that do the same thing.
Any questions from members or audience members? Mr. Sullivan, to your knowledge, are any states, I think most area farm states have some laws pertaining to corporate farms. And I thought I read someplace that one state might be looking at relaxing those a little bit to attract more dairy farms. Have you heard or seen anything about other states changing their laws pertaining to corporate land ownership?
Mr. Chair, I haven't, but I haven't looked into the issue recently. That certainly could be the case, but I'm not aware of it.
Thank you. Any other questions? We are going to be adjourning here. There is going to be a tour of the plant over at the Department of Ag, their lab over there. And in case you've forgotten, it's Representatives Backer, Nornis, Rarick, Schultz, Sundin, and some researchers. CLA is going, and also Ken Savory. So that's coming up about 10 minutes after we adjourn today. And then also a couple of tours tomorrow. And I don't believe that we aren't going to be having Ag Finance tomorrow. Representative Hamilton?
Okay. We're doing tours as well.
Okay. That's great. And tomorrow it's Bennett, Daniels, Fabian, Franzen, Keel, Metza, Miller, and Mark Anderson. And that's the 10 o'clock tour. And then 11 o'clock it'll be Representatives Applebaum, Johnson, Lewick, Pearson, Poppy, and our CA Mark Nisley. So That's the schedule for the rest of today in the Ag Committee, and also tomorrow, the tours of the lab. Very interesting over at the Department of Ag building. I've been there a couple of times, so I'm not going to go with you on the tour this time. Any other questions or comments? And thank you, Mr. Sullivan. A very broad and good overview of some of the programs that we will be dealing with throughout the year. No other questions? If not, the meeting is adjourned.